House Bill 2212.
Mark, you want to explain what we're looking at?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2212, limits the personal information of the Oregon no-call list database to only telephone numbers of parties who do not wish to receive the telephone solicitations at their listed numbers. Prohibits the Attorney General and the no-call list administrator from disclosing names, residence addresses, and the methods of fee payment of parties who do not wish to receive telephone solicitations. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Cheryl, you want to come up and tell us about the bill? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Hill, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section of the Department of Justice. This House Bill 2212 is the department's bill, and I hesitate to characterize it as a technical fix to the law, but in a way that's what it is. I've provided a written testimony, and I'll leave that to the committee members to read. I'll just highlight what 2212 does and why we believe it's necessary. And please, if you have any questions about the no-call law in general, I'd be happy to answer them. 2212 essentially does two things. First, it clarifies what is already contained in the statute. And at ORS 646574, it directs the list administrator, which is a private entity contracted by the Attorney General, to create, maintain, and distribute a database that contains a list of telephone numbers of people who don't want to be called by telephone solicitors. We are fairly confident that the language of that statute means just what it says, and that the list of telephone numbers means that the list shall contain only the telephone numbers of parties. And that interpretation is buttressed by the fact that in Section 3, it prohibits the list administrator from releasing any information about a party except under very limited circumstances, and it does not ever mention a telephone solicitor as one of the people or one of the entities that's able to obtain information about a party. Still, there's been some confusion voiced by several telemarketers. This was early on in the implementation of the program, and we felt it best to clarify by including the language in 646575, language that the list contains only the telephone numbers of parties who do not wish to receive telephone solicitation. So that's the first thing it does. It just clarifies that the list means telephone numbers only. The second...
Can I interrupt you there?
Absolutely.
I'm not familiar with this program.
Oh.
Is it for a period, or is it I want to be on the list, I submit it, and then I don't have to do anything more?
Chairman Hill, initially, if you wanted to sign up your residence phone number on the list, you'd pay $6.50 for the first year, and then $3 per year thereafter to renew. And as long as you renewed in a timely fashion, your telephone number would remain on the list.
So, so the add and delete are done yearly.
Actually, Chair Hill, they were done on a month-to-month basis for the first year. We're in the process of changing that, and we're going to be doing it on a quarterly basis. So the list administrator will add names to the list within 4 days of after a registration form is received, but the list is itself, the updated list, is not published but 4 times a year.
Okay, so there's no requirement for us to subject. If I move, I have to pay like $6. We're not having created the situation. We're going to start prorating $6.50 for people who say, I paid in January, I moved in May, I don't want to pay another $6.
Chairman Hill, that I don't know that that's come up, but I believe that the registration form states that this fee is non-refundable, and you pay for the number, and if you lose your number, then you're off the list, and if you want to sign your new number up, then you do have to pay $6.50.
A couple of technical questions, if I could, Mr. Chair. So I think a number remains idle for a year before it can be reissued by the phone company. I'm not sure how I know that. I just think I heard that, or maybe I picked it up out of the ether. But there's no problem then with the number not receiving solicitations should somebody in the household actually want them.
Chair Hill, Representative Lowe, make sure I'm understanding what you're asking. If I sign my number up for the no-call list,
and then you move,
and then I leave Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and my number is reassigned,
mm-hmm. Are you still on the no-call list?
The number would be, however, the list administrator under the terms of the contract is required under the quality assurance plan to perform random audits.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that the numbers on the list are still active numbers and have not been reassigned. So I guess I'm answering your yes and no. Yes, there is a chance that if the number is reassigned by a telephone company, the number may be on the list regardless of whether or not the new subscriber has signed it up, unless it's identified through a random audit by the list administrator.
And by virtue of the fact that you're on this list, what happens when a solicitor tries to call your number?
Chair Hill, Representative Lowe, the statute's prohibitions are enforced by the Department of Justice. So what happens now is if your phone number is on a list and you receive a call by our telephone solicitation, as it's defined, from a telemarketer who has a copy of the list, and it's not a telephone solicitation that's exempt, you would report it to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice would institute an investigation to find out when your number went on the list, if the telemarketer is a telemarketer who is exempt from having to get the list, when they got the list, or if they even had paid for it. And if we had established that a violation occurred, then we would take enforcement action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That's the enforcement mechanism contemplated by the law.
Okay, one more question, if I could, please. Thank you. Ms. Pellegrin, one other question. And looking at the language of House Bill 22-112, do you have an administrative rule or some sort of a way to handle situations where several adults might have one telephone in a residence and only one of them wishes to be placed on the no-call list? How would that, if the other ones want to enjoy the interruptions that this endeavor brings, how would you handle that under the language of 2212?
Chairman Hill, Representative Lowe, the subscriber of the phone number, the person who pays the bill is the person who, under this law, has the authority to sign the number up. So if there are other telephone or if there are other members of the household that wish to receive telephone calls, I guess the fix is that they can get their own phone line and not sign it up with a different number.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Very briefly, the second feature of House Bill 2212 is this. The list administrator, who's under contract with the Attorney General to run the program, is required by the terms of the contract to provide a database on a quarterly basis, just as security, and to make sure that in the event the contract defaults, that at least the department has something of the database to then give to the next administrator. Because the whole program contains phone numbers, names, addresses, and method of payment, and because once in the possession of the Department of Justice, which is a public agency, we are subject to public records requests, there is a concern that a telemarketer may be able, through indirect means, to accomplish that which is prohibited directly by the no-call law. In other words, if a telemarketer were to make a public records request on the Department of Justice for the database program, applied by the contractor. While we believe there are at least two exemptions currently existing in public records law that would exempt the records from disclosure, there's a concern that we're uncertain how the courts may rule on that. And so to protect the privacy of the individuals who have signed up for the list, the second part of House Bill 2212 makes clear that information about a party is confidential and that the Attorney General may not disclose information about a party, which means that it's exempt from the public records law.
Nothing in here says you're putting that information on a telephone number in the list to begin with. So
that's correct.
So from that perspective, why don't you not put telephone addresses and names of the individuals and just put telephone numbers in the list? So that whole issue would be then moved.
Chair Hill, there are two different databases. The first is the database with the small d, and that's actually the list which just contains the phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the list administrator under 646574, subsection 3, A and B, say that the list administrator may provide a copy of the list to either a person wants to engage in telephone solicitations or on request of a qualified trade association.
Okay.
Now, the second part is that the administrator is required under the contract to provide to the Attorney General a backup of the entire program. So that if this contractor were to default or something would happen, then it could no longer perform its duties under the contract. The Department of Justice wouldn't have to start from the beginning and could furnish that database to the next contract administrator.
So are they meeting this request from the telephone company to be on this list? Or do they contact the Department of Justice to be on the list?
Chair Hill, you would contact the Oregon No Call Program, which is a local number. It's the private list administrator. It's contracted by the Department of Justice. We don't operate the list, we enforce the law. And we sort of over.
Who operates the list?
The list administrator. In this case, it's
Telephone Association.
It's Oregon OTA Services LLC,
okay,
which is different than Oregon Telecommunications Association.
Essentially the same people.
Yes.
Okay. Why do they keep anything other than the telephone number? I'm just a silly question.
Chair Hill, I believe the reason why they find the names, addresses, and payment information useful to keep in their database is because as people renew, people start allowing renewals by phone or online. They already have the account information, and it's just a lot easier administratively.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right.
Chairman Hill, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and we are actually we administer the program, the no-call program that we're discussing here today. We don't actually do the work. We subcontract that out to a company down in Georgia.
There's nobody in Oregon that does this work? There's nobody in Oregon that does this work?
Chairman, no, that's correct. We are the middleman between the Department of Justice and a company called Computer Business Services located in Georgia. They maintain the database through us and through the Department of Justice.
Okay.
Okay. Chairman, no, the OTA obviously supports House Bill 2212, and the reason for my appearance here today is not to discuss anything Mr. Pellegrini has discussed, but rather some proposed amendments to the bill, to the program itself, and to the bill. The program's working really well, but currently, if you were to subscribe to the bill right now, you would renew in January, regardless of when you signed up. If you signed up in November or December, you still have to renew in January. The administrator of the program requested that we introduce some language that would change that to allow a renewal based on whatever month you you signed up in. So it's kind of like a rolling renewal. So you would, if you signed up in May, you'd have to renew in May versus everybody signing up in January.
I just have a question. Why aren't the phone companies billing for, I mean, if I call up, I order my phone service, I say, I don't want these telemarketers calling me. Was there a reason? Can you tell me what the telecommunications industry kind of line is on that particular logic? It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me from a consumer standpoint that I have to pay to some Oregon Telecommunications Association, LLC, or whatever it is.
Sure. Chairman Hill, Representative Patrick, I'm not that familiar with how the program began or why it's being run through a separate type of situation like that. I'm sure there are other people in the room who could probably answer that question, but I don't think, I'm not able to answer that question for you.
Okay.
The real question is, do we want that answer to that question? So.
If he can't answer the question, I'll find out some other way, I guess. I don't see anyone jumping up and volunteering, so I'll laugh at an appropriate time.
We can make volunteers. Jimmy, come up. Thank you for volunteering. Well,
good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest. Last session, when this idea came along, it was actually it came from a member of the Oregon Telecommunications Association who had been working with the black dot situation that we had here in Oregon for many years, whereby telephone subscribers could call their respective telephone companies and pay on a monthly basis to have a black dot put beside their names in the telephone directories. That was not an altogether satisfactory situation for consumers because there are so many different places where solicitors can get information about telephone subscribers, including, you know, just having a machine that calls every number possible, whether it's a real subscriber or not. So the thought was, this person came with an idea that he had picked up from another state that said, why don't we centralize this situation, put it in the hands of the Attorney General's office, have a third party administer it so that it's not being run by the government or by the industry, have subscribers pay once a year for the service so that it's essentially an electronic version of the advertising, I forget what the Advertising Association is in New York, where you can ask, you know, not to get junk mail. So in a nutshell, that's my recollection. Thank you. Direct Marketing Association.
Can I then have a follow-up then?
Yes, you may.
Jenny, so is there a reason? Do the phone companies not want to administer this in terms of, I can understand that there's a third party to administer the list, and to me that makes some sense, but now we raise, the billing question, and my question is, to me it makes more sense to, when you order service, for that to be a service that the phone company submits to the third party piece. I don't know if that's just a substantial problem to this whole issue, or substantial problem in terms of administrative overhead to the phone companies.
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, I don't know that I can completely answer your question, but I can tell you that what are now being marketed as privacy products are available by telecommunications companies when you sign up for service. For example, you can get call blocker and a whole host of services, but they cost and you're assessed on a month-to-month basis. So those services are being provided. They're essentially in competition with a no-call list. I mean, they seek to do the same thing, which is to block unwanted phone calls. from the state's perspective, the no-call list is a lot more economical than the constellation of services or products offered by the telecommunications companies. But, in fact, they do offer them.
Well, I guess, sir, to me that doesn't make sense, though, because I understand how call blocking services and those things work, but if it's an unsolicited call, I don't think that the... I don't know, maybe you can order that for your phone as a service to say you don't want any unsolicited calls, but I mean, I don't understand how that would work.
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, an unsolicited call, I think it would be really hard to determine which calls were solicited, which calls you wanted and which calls you didn't. Mrs. Lang was saying, a lot of telemarketers use what are called automatic dialing devices, and they just go through a computer program and just automatically dial numbers until you get a live answer, and then a person comes on. So I don't know how you block those.
Perhaps we could just require and want it. I think the lady thought it's incorrect on this bill, but on the caller ID, it just simply says, do you have an answer? But the relating clause is wrong in this bill.
I guess, I mean, we're not going to work session this bill today, but I'd just be interested in knowing if we're going to discuss billing and whether you bill once monthly or annually or whatever. To me, it makes more sense to, as someone who comes to the legislature, I guess, turns off my phone service at home for 6 months, comes to the legislature, and maybe we're in a unique situation, but, you know, in terms of, it would make more sense, I think, if this bill was intended to be a consumer advocacy kind of bill to prevent unsolicited calls, that to have the phone companies charge what it costs them to submit to the list, it would make more sense to me. But anyway, I don't know.
Cheryl, are you okay with the amendments to grant this?
Yes, Representative, or Chairman, we are. I think that Peter Shepard had talked to Brandt the other day, and we're fine. We actually think that
was drafted. Have you also talked to other industry players? And is everybody? I talked to one who had some questions. So,
Chairman, regarding the amendments?
No. So.
Chairman Hill, the association has supported the bill, so we've discussed it at our legislative committee meetings, and industry representatives are there.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Any other questions?
I haven't seen the proposed amendments, so I'd like to take a little peek. There they are.
So we'll get them drafted in LC form, and we'll have the bill back when it.
I have a question.
Representative Patrick?
How many people are actually signed up on this list?
You didn't mention that in there just a
In this letter? Is it in your letter?
Yeah.
It's in
40,400.
So I guess people know about it.
Yeah.
729 telephone solicitors have paid for the list.
It's working well. It's and if you signed up for the service, you know that. I'm not trying to sell it here, but it really does work. I signed up for it myself when I became aware of it, and it is a great consumer product, I think.
And if I may, Chair Hill, I think one of the reasons for its success is that it's constructed in such a way that the department can meaningfully enforce the law. We've taken 35 court actions over the last 3 months against violators,
right.
And the number of telephone solicitors between December and January jumped from like 428 to about 630. So I think the fact that it's being aggressively enforced is what is making it work so well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we will close. So is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 2212? Hearing and seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2212. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2727. Mark, do you want to... Let us know what we're talking about.
Sure, certainly. Chair Hill, members of the committee, House Bill 2727 provides the application of certain laws governing telecommunications services to unincorporated associations and cooperative corporations, does not authorize the Public Utility Commission to establish terms, conditions, classifications, or rates for services rendered to members of these associations or corporations, nor does it give the Commission general powers of regulation over unincorporated associations and cooperative corporations that provide telecommunications services. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. This bill has resulted basically from, I think, a series of communication problems that have occurred over the last few years. House Bill 2727 sets out some very clear distinctions, I think, or makes it very clear the distinctions between a telecommunications utility and cooperatives and their concomitant PUC authority. Oregon statutes clearly distinguish between telecommunications utilities and cooperatives. This difference has not really been properly recognized, I don't feel, by the Public Utility Commission. In recent years, it appears that they've expanded their scope of regulation to cooperatives, despite general provisions in ORS 759. This seems contradictory to the entire industry trend to deregulate. And indeed, I guess I'd be looking at Mobil, US West, Quest type of activities, and yet here we are trying to increase regulation of some of the smaller cooperatives, especially those cooperatives that seem to be providing excellent rates that are directly accountable to their local boards for any little misstep, and actually penalizing them for providing competition in some very ingenious ways to assist their customers. This bill is a compromise, kind of recognizes that the PUC does have some limited authority over co-ops, as outlined in statute, with interstate, intrastate telecommunication services, but allows the local board to establish the terms, conditions, and rates to its own members, which seems the way and the trend that we should be going to at this time. I have a limited knowledge of this fairly in-depth field. Gentleman to my left, Mr. Lindstrom, is president of the Beaver Creek Telephone Cooperative Association and can give you more details, and I believe he has some testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I wish to wish, I know we're not voting just yet, but I just wanted on the record that I have a potential conflict of interest in that I have been a member of Beaver Creek Telephone Cooperative and have received money from them in the form of dividends.
Very well.
Thank
it'll
you.
Be noted for the record. Welcome.
Chairman Hill and the rest of the committee, my name is Tom Lindstrom, and I'm the CEO president of Beaver Creek Cooperative Telephone Company. Beaver Creek currently is owned by 4,800 customers that are current members, and we are also have ownership by people who are no longer members that have moved out of the area, and they are still entitled to assets as a cooperative. And currently we serve about 2,700 cable customers and about 1,000 internet customers. I think the main purpose of House Bill 2727 is to clarify the line where the commission's authorities related to cooperatives begins and it ends. You know, and over the years, we've had a lot of issues in front of the commission trying to resolve them. We've been in court trying to resolve them over what a statute as basically stated. You know, this goes back to 1985 and House Bill 2200, 1987 and House Bill 2655. And we've always run into conflicting statements from the commission of really what their authority has. And we've gone out and done a lot of legal research and we've really hit a stone wall. And, you know, history, and even in my testimony copy, which you have, we even have Attorney General's opinion dated back to 1967, which basically really clearly states that co-ops are not telecommunications utilities, we're not public utilities, we only serve our members only, and therefore we're not, we don't have regulation from the co-op, I mean from the Public Utilities Commission. You know, it's very simple, you know, cooperatives are very member managed.
Who would they member of the co-op go to seek redress in terms of, I mean, since this clearly takes the commission out on terms, conditions, classifications, or rates, and generally takes it under the general powers of regulation. So who would a member of the cooperative go to seek redress?
Currently under Title 62 statutes, which I have a copy here for Chairman Hill, that basically says that the members appoint a board of directors, and they go to the board of directors with issues. We have monthly open board meetings. We also have annual meetings. And right now, looking from the outside in as a co-op, if you need something dealt with in a hurry through the co-op, I would say somewhere between 30 and 60 days, you could resolve an issue if it's a rate issue, if it's maybe a customer being mistreated. If you try to do it through the regulatory process today, it would take up to a minimum 2 years. And, you know, it's clear that when the legislature adopted Title 62 statutes back whenever co-ops were established, that they wanted the boards to manage these companies. They're the owners. I mean, we only serve them. I deal with members. Members call me 24 hours a day, and I'm the president of the company. We have an open policy. They call me. They call me Saturdays. They call me Sundays. And, you know, we service them within a two-hour period. End of story.
But I'm trying to get directed. I mean, you're a cooperative which is operating efficiently, so you can make that argument that it doesn't make sense to have this, and it becomes, you know, there's a problem. I'm looking at a situation where maybe you're no longer running it, and they choose somebody else, and because we rely on telephone service for basic public safety issues in terms of tying into 911 and those types of things, and someone's and a board decides they're not going to do certain things, with, you know, where does someone go? Where do we have that you're still covered by some requirements, and there's some place in terms of we're looking from a regulatory, you know, that you're not creating a telephone system which is substandard or non-standard in terms of integration with the public switch network.
Chairman Hill and the rest of the committee, under Title 62 statutes, it basically states that if a member comes in and they have an issue with the board and the board says we choose to do it this way, the membership then will call a special meeting. They could call a meeting at any time under our current bylaws and then vote out the board.
How many people does it require to call a special meeting?
One. And, you know, and to the date, I've been with Beaver Creek for going on almost 20 years. When a member requests a meeting with the board, I have never seen it in my company, as well as any of the other companies, ever they've ever been denied.
So in these associations, is it if I show up with 10 of my friends, I can take over the telephone company, or is there a requirement, is there a quorum requirement on membership? I'm just, I'm in Verizon territory, so this is foreign to me. I'm just curious.
Chairman Hill and the rest of the committee, it takes a vote of the membership, and we could vote by mail, but it has to be called. You would call a special meeting of the membership, and the co-op is mandated to call that special meeting under our bylaws, current bylaws, and the members then will be asked, you know, the position of whoever, if it's you and 10 of your friends, and they're all members that say they'd like to replace the board because all of a sudden our rates are doubled, that can be changed. They dictate to us what our rates will be. And, I mean, again, speaking on behalf of Beaver Creek, and I can't speak for the other 10 co-ops, most of the co-ops today are lower cost than a lot of the other companies, and we have just never heard problems because of rates.
Do you participate in the Universal Service Fund?
On the federal level, yes, we do. We also contribute money. We collect money today for the state USF fund, which the small rural companies are not party of as of today. But we do collect money.
So is your intention that you then draw out of the USF fund? I mean, I don't know. You're probably not a high-cost area, or are you?
Fall
within the high cost?
For interstate, we are because of our density. For state, I'm not really sure where that is as of today. But even if we were on that case, the commission would have the ability with universal service to look at our rates and costs in order to determine, because again, we're not billing our members, and this is only talking about billing directly to our members.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at, you know, you make some broad statements, but yet you're going to come in and go to USF, and then you could claim that, well, We're not under the powers of the PUC. I just want to make sure we craft it the appropriate way. If you participate in USF and you're going to drop from the USF, you're subject to the USF regulation. On
correct. Chairman Hill, that's still correct. We believe we are still subject to the commission's jurisdiction.
May I? Thank you. It's not clear to me what regulations you're seeking to avoid.
Chairman Hill and Representative Lowe, it's not really regulations that we're trying to avoid. They're regulation statute that we feel is in place today, and we believe that the commission are not following the intent of the legislature. And we believe it, you know, we believe, and we have, and that's why over the years we've have had these running battles with the commission, is that they don't have jurisdiction over rates, like for local rates, EAS rates, since I bill my members and the board of directors do. But something always comes up, and staff always tries to expand their regulatory authority. I don't know if they're trying to keep their jobs, or I don't know. I just don't know. But they're trying to expand their authority, and it's real difficult when they come out and mandate stuff from co-ops that we say, really, you don't have authority. And
let me rephrase my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Patridge. What regulations have been imposed upon you that you find inappropriate?
Chairman Hill and Representative Lowe, give an example. When House Bill 2655 was adopted, which brought into law 759225, at that point, the industry thought that at that point it was Representative Ekus who was carrying this for us and helped us get this bill passed. It was our understanding, as well as even in the, if you would review the hearing notes, that this was for to give the commission the authority when there was a through service and a joint rate where two utilities sharing that rate, they would split it based on a percentage of their facilities versus a percentage of the other company's facilities. That, and if there was ever a dispute over that rate, or if another utility, like Quest, for example, today offers operator services, but we are not large enough to operate our own operator services, so our tariff basically states that we use Quest for operator services and comply within their rates and give 100% of the money to Quest, because there is no shared money for operator services, and then they bill us accordingly. Well, if Quest decides, say, well, we no longer want to operate operator or offer operator services to anybody else other than Quest customers, we would then go to the commission and file a complaint, because we would have no other way to seek this for our members, and our members would be then deprived of having a service. And that's what the intent was. And with time, you know, the laws really haven't changed. We just don't understand to date. We have letters from prior commissioners that basically, you know, states that it's illogical for the commission to regulate co-ops, that the members know best, that the board of directors know best. We have a whole bunch of, you know.
But I still don't understand what they've tried to regulate that negatively affects the members of the co-op. I don't understand. I understand, you know, I guess from a philosophical standpoint, for lack of a better reason, that you don't want to be regulated by the PUC, but what has the PUC done that would cause us to move more legislation forward that negatively affects your the people that are involved in your cooperatives? Can you give us an example?
Chairman Hill and Representative Lowe and Patrick, I'll give you a very good example. As you're aware, in last session, a law was passed that asked the governor to set up a task force in House Bill 3615 to review the operations of the commission. And as this task force was assigned, Beaver Creek Telephone participated in that task force. knowingly that as we gave testimony that we would, I guess, be pulled aside and be intimidated and picked on by the Public Utility Commission. And a number of the other telephone companies felt the same way. But we were still there. We were up front explaining to this task force why we felt the commission was not keeping up with the current times and standards. And as a result of that, Beaver Creek Telephone has its own EAS rates, and these rates have been in place since 1993, and we have adjusted them. Our board has adopted them as needed based on our cost. And because of the expansion of the internet, our costs were actually, and I'm going to shoot from memory, original cost 1993 was somewhere right around $400,000 annually. And because of the internet, it jumped to $1.4 million. And a lot of that was based on internet traffic. Well, we went out to the membership, we talked to the members, we talked to the national organizations, talked to everybody about coming up with a solution. How to reduce our cost, because our cost, because the more lines that you add, the more cost, because they rate, they base cost on minutes of use between toll, EAS, and local. And so our EAS minutes of use were just growing tenfold. We came up with a solution, went to the membership and said, what we can do is we could go out and spend $250,000 and buy what we call a data switch and route data traffic over this data switch to your internet provider and get you off the voice network, or we could increase trunks of the voice network and increase your EAS rates by $3 or $4 a month. Basically, the membership came back and said, well, first of all, are you talking about 4,800 customers, or are you talking about how many customers? We said, well, we're talking about 1% of our customers. We're pushing 0.75% of our cost, about 250 customers out of 4,800. And they basically came back and said, wait a minute, that isn't right. Those customers should then pay for their usage, and the rest of us shouldn't raise our rates. And they also said, well, we would like you to buy a data switch, you know, give us some alternative. So that's what we did. And then we established rates for users that were tying up our network for 50, 60, 70 hours a month. And after we were getting to some evenings where our network was blocked because of the internet providers. Well, at that point, the commission called us into a hearing. They had a complaint. They did not notify us of a complaint. They put me in front of a public hearing, humiliated me in the press, and said we did all this stuff wrong. When the board set the rates, it went through all the legal processes, and they retaliated against Beaver Creek Telephone, and they had no authority. So right now, at the tune of about $15,000 later, we have this in courts in Clackamas County, showing that the commission has no authority. This law, this clarifying law, would stop that from happening, because they had no authority.
Just, if I may, Tom knows this stuff inside and out. He's been dealing with it for a bunch of years, as you can tell, and so he gets into some pretty technical analysis of this, but he's basically right. There are three issues, I think, that are the genesis and the reason that this body should move forward. Number one is customer satisfaction, delivering good product service in a reasonable amount of time. Tom's testified, I think, pretty well that in a short period of time, the cooperative can deal with problems, get the issue done, change rates, be responsive to the community's needs, that in his district, in these small cooperative areas, that a big utility cannot necessarily deal with. If they go through the PUC process, it's going to take forever. Second issue, I think, is just a cost factor. These guys can offer great rates. They're very responsive. They don't have a lot of overhead compared to other jurisdictions. And if the PUC wants to run up the cost by making go through a lot of AG fees, deal with ALJs and all the different types of legal morass that we see these small, I see it all when I'm testifying or dealing with small health boards and Ways and Means Subcommittee. This is a way to increase costs. It's unnecessary, particularly in this era where we're trying to foster competition on a level playing field. I think the Public Utility Commission is slightly misguided in their over-interest in this area. And the last point is philosophy. Shouldn't this be a local control issue? Is this a, I think the legislature needs to send a message is, you know, should the cooperatives be able to do their own thing in this era of deregulation, provided they have the safeguards that Chairman Hill questioned Mr. Lindstrom about? Or is this another area that we need to have more regulation in by the Public Utility Commission? I would suggest to you that the answer is no on that last account. Those are the three reasons.
And I guess you, the example you gave sort of draws some concern to me, because in terms of, because what if the decision was not to buy a data switch and to basically go to measured service, and so you would then be having the 250 people paying about $2,500 a month, and calculating that on the 600,000 delta between the two things. You know, $2,500, is that a year figure? The 1.2 million or whatever figure you had?
That's annual cost.
So you'd have about $2,500 cost to a user. I guess sort of, those are the kind of the issues in terms of what sort of drive me to sort of question, in terms of if we don't have something that's looking at some overall policies, you may be driven from an economic standpoint, which then hampers the ability for people to participate, because the majority of people are going, wait a second, I don't want to do this, you know. But, you know, how do you sort of bring in new technologies in terms of, you know, you probably probably want a frame switch, and then you're just going to be like DSL or something now to try to get people off the voice switch?
Chairman Hill, that's correct, and that's one of the things that we looked at, and if the board chose not to go with the frame relay switch and decided to increase cost, and I guess one thing that our representative Lowe brought forward is she does get patronage dividends. I'm here to assure you that these customers that we charge in that circumstance that I gave you, that paid the extra usage, received far more capital credit dollars back, because everything's based on what you use with the co-op. So if you've got a customer that's only using $100 a month or $1,200 a year versus a customer that's spending $3,000 a month or $36,000, he's going to get far more earnings of this co-op back and own more of the company. But I can't see a member, it's hard for me to understand a member would all of a sudden see their rates go 3, 4, 5 times up and not scream and not change the board philosophy, change the board or change the management of this company to say, wait a minute, here's how we're going to do it. And that's what, I think that's how co-ops were founded. And I think this is, every state in the nation is the same way. It's the members that dictate and direct.
I guess my concern, though, is if it's all driven from a bottom line perspective, then, you know, the telephone rings, I can pick it up and it works, and therefore there's no need to invest in new technology, bring new technologies out, which could then have a positive effect in terms of, I mean, we've been on the other side of this, driving policies, pushing the PUC, you know, on capital investment and trying to free up, you know, the rate of return, those types of things, so that we are encouraging investment. And I just want to make sure there's a balance here, so that we don't reduce the pressure, you know, on the co-op in terms of deliver services, and there's something out there driving it in the balance. So it's not just a case of, you know, if I turn the crank 4 times, it's always worked for me, and I can always talk to Aunt Sarah, you know, versus, you know, somebody else has a digital phone, you know, and you're a step-by-step switch just because it works, and, you know.
Chairman Hill, I guess my answer to that would be simply that the you know, if the majority of the members in the co-op wanted to just ring up their phone like 1930s, that's their prerogative. I would suggest to you that's not the case nowadays. They want the same level of service that our urban users have. And to that extent, I think that drives Beaver Creek Telephone, Canby Telephone, all the different districts that, yes, you know, we're going to offer these services. It may cost some of these members a little bit more. They have that discussion, and they either move forward based on what the cooperative wants to do or not, and that's, I think, a pretty good process.
Chairman Hill, I'd like to comment on additional statement by Representative Schrader. I think this changing of law really isn't changing the guidance of do we bring new technology to our members or not. It's our members. And to give you an example, the co-ops today, and I'll speak specifically of Beaver Creek, I have DSL through my whole exchange today. True DSL, any member, for $35 a month that they can have at any time. And I would like to, and I mean, and I serve 62 square miles, and I have some customers that 1.9 customers per mile, and I serve them all. That's the co-op plus. I have to, when the FCC gave me the license to build cable TV, they said, you will build 100%, no ifs, ands, or buts. And we have So we have to. I mean, that's...
Let me ask you, Tom, you made a comment in terms of participation on the House Bill 3615 task force. You made a comment about, you know, you were going to go and you participated in it, knowing that you'd be pulled aside and it would be sort of retribution or intimidation. Was there any specific time where your staff or commission members pulled you aside and suggested you not express your opinion as to the changes on that task force?
Chairman Hill, no. Being in the industry as long as we have, there's many other ways that they can get to us without verbally doing so, and we've seen it many, many times. And I think that, and I'm not just going to say Beaver Creek, and I think that if an article in the Statesman Journal about when OTA gave their comments, how Commissioner Ickes attacked OTA, I think it's common knowledge. I mean,
we hear it all the time.
Yes.
Where the utility are afraid to come and testify, sit up here, because they know that there will be retribution. And that was part of the discussion in
right.
terms of the task force, and I'm just trying to understand what that means and how we address it as legislators. Different topics.
I wanted
to touch on that and try to get on the record.
I would say, Chairman Hill, we're not here for this, and I really don't want to open up any more can of worms. And you know, this legislation is really, it's just like I said from the beginning, it's very clean cut. It allows the co-op board to run its co-op and the members to run its own business.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? For committee members, I apologize. We did not get PC in time to get them to come. You can bring us back, and we would like them to come and testify at our next meeting so that we can get all the country if they would like to come and testify.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2727? Hearing and seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2727. And with that, if there are no further business to agree, we will, without objection, adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been wonderful studying the end.